This is Boston Public Radio.
89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1 Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3 to take on the moral dilemmas of the day, as they do every Monday for All Revved Up, our Reverend Irene Monroe. And Emmett Price, Reverend Irene Monroe, is a syndicated religion columnist. Reverend Emmett Price is a professor of music at Northeastern University. Hello to both of you, too.
Hey, thanks for having us back.
Glad to be here.
Thank you both for coming in. Well, there have been protests all around the country involving the people's dissatisfaction with no indictment following the killing of Eric Garner at the hands of police in Staten Island. But surprisingly, we had reactions that I didn't expect from a couple of local leaders. Deval Patrick was on television yesterday morning. He was on CNN asking what we are trying to accomplish with these protests beyond disruption, which rather surprised me. We got a little sound now from Marty Walsh. There have been a lot of protests in Boston as well. And here's the mayor of the city of Boston talking about the protests.
Holding a sign saying Black Lives Matter is important, but we're actually having conversations about it. I don't know any of the protesters that are at any of the tables with us discussing these issues.
We had 23 people arrested, but it wasn't a bad scene. But I don't know, Emmett, they seem to be losing their enthusiasm kind of soon. Two guys I thought would be more in for a longer amount of time.
Yeah, I mean, they're politicians. I mean, you know, and they're being pushed by a number of different constituencies. Protesters are disruptive. They are disruptive. I mean, they are getting in the way to make the point that things cannot continue as status quo or as the norm. And my thing is, you should not ask the victims or the people who feel like they are being not empowered or not treated equally to come up with their own solution. So I'm not sure that the protesters need to be the ones to come to the table with the solution, or if they need to sit at the table anyway, because at that table are usually the same people who are invited to sit in the same seat, who show up to the meetings at the same time on the same day in the same room.
And so I'm not sure. Your point is they're there to highlight the problem, and it's up to you, whoever you are,
to be responsible. To be responsible to your position.
I just need to say this: they're not even doing a good job at highlighting the problem. I'm all right if they want to say, listen, an older generation needs to step aside, and an older or generations needs to sit down. But I'm worried about a younger generation's fortitude to sustain this movement when they want an extension on their exams because they've been out protesting.
You weren't
defeats
down.
The
that
purpose
was,
of
Harvard.
What
Harvard Law School.
Well, it's
not Harvard.
It's
Georgetown.
It's not just Harvard. It's really a bunch of schools. I mean, it's a whole bunch of schools. So it talks about a generation of kids, you know, that don't understand sacrifice.
Well, that's not really unfair to generalize. There are a couple of people who are a little full of themselves who thought that the way you show sacrifice is by the university sacrificing and not having you take your test. I don't think it seems to me they're more the outliers.
Some people claim that they were traumatized. I don't know. Did you buy that they were traumatized to take their test?
If they were, or if they are, I mean, that's a valid point. I mean, for them to do some self-introspection, I mean, I don't know if you can be a criminal attorney and have a death threat on you and feel like you can't try the case because you're traumatized by the theft threat. I think there's a sense of self-introspection that one has to take among themselves. And all the law schools that are dealing with the situation already have process and procedures on the books anyway for these situations. And so I think,
you know, case by case basis kind of.
So I don't think generational thing.
They're another problem. Another problem is, you know, how do we support our allies? So I have a quote from someone that you two know.
Who's
that? Sue O'Connell.
Yes.
Wrote me this morning. She's the editor and co-publisher
of Bay Windows.
And she says to me, white people who are involved are feeling very confused, especially those who have been working for social justice forever. Invited to speak at a rally, then getting the stare down by young organizers. She says it would be helpful to have how to be an ally primer. And I agree with her because there are people who come out.
I mean, if you're not black, is that the point?
Right,
that's the point?
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, and Boston has a group that is certainly, you know, a white group that really want to be very active in this. And they're called Boston White Racial Justice People. That's the name of the group here.
And they're,
and stuff.
And they're great people. They are absolutely, and Sue is phenomenal. And the number of allies are phenomenal people. But I don't think this is the same model, this same mechanism from the civil rights movement, where you have a core group of leaders who had internal issues themselves, right? Because even they castigated the women and some of the folks who didn't, have the right profiles to the side. So these young people, this generation, is not necessarily trying to solve the problem. They're trying to bring awareness to the problem with the hopes that those who are elected officials, those who are put in these positions, who are charged and challenged with being the solution makers and the thinkers,
but it needs an intersectional analysis. It really
does.
What
does that mean?
Meaning it's like if we want to bring attention to policing, we got to understand how policing not only affects African American young males, but also how policing affects immigrants or people who are perceived to be immigrants, people who are perceived in certain parts of the country of being LGBTQ. I agree that we don't need the sort of civil rights model, which is very hierarchical. We really do need something that's coalition building. But when I get an email from a white ally like Sue O'Connell saying, look, there's a contingent of us that like to be down there but don't know how to be there,
well, wait a minute.
Tells you that that you feel like you're on a journey without a roadmap.
Hold on. Are you saying that – I wasn't clear because Jim asked about this before. I'm not really clear entirely what this means, that because she's white and gay, she was not welcome to the program.
She couldn't get on the platform.
And so the point is that sometimes when you are used to being on the platform and being a very powerful speaker and coalescer or whatnot, sometimes the best way that you can be an activist and be a participant is just to listen.
That's not being negated. But the point is that if this is supposed to be a multicultural, intergenerational movement or moment, then we need to hear from all folks.
I could see where you could be. I mean, I could see, there was a bunch of white people lying down in Brookline, and I thought that was great that they were lying down in Brookline. But I could see where you would want the leaders, at least now, I would think, to be the young black men and women.
But we're saying that there are no leaders. And see, I think...
on the platform, what Emma's talking about. You know what I mean? Okay. If you're going to get up and give a speech...
But then it negates the point that we want this to be multicultural. It makes the point that we want it to be multiracial. Because see, if you just talk about the policing of black men and not the policing of people who are perceived to be immigrant and how it also works in other aspects of American life, then you defeat the purpose.
Irene Monroe, what movement that matters has ever been successful without leaders? Can you name
without
one?
Without leaders?
Without leaders, yeah.
I can't name one. I thought one that
so
was...
So why is this the one that's going to all of a sudden succeed?
I thought a kernel of it was going to be the Occupy movement.
Yeah.
Because its tentacles were all over the place. It really drew in people across different socioeconomic backgrounds, all groups of people. So I was hoping that was sort of the nascent stages of what a movement would look like in terms of coalition building.
It depends on how you define success, right? Because in terms of being a catalyst for getting a new generation, active and conscious of some of the issues that were going on, I thought the Occupy Wall Street movement was very successful.
Well, they gave us some words that we can now put in.
Can I answer my own question? One of our producers came up with an answer.
What?
A movement that has been very successful, where I think the average person could name leaders, I don't know if they're being facetious or not. How about the Tea Party? Is while you can identify individual members.
Oh, you were
the
there.
The Michelle Bachmans. No, I'm serious. But they've had a huge impact on public policy.
Let me just say something. I think Emmett and I are closer on this. It's fine to have other people there, but it's kind of like the women's movement. When the women's movement was beginning, I didn't want to hear any men on the platform. And I think this is primarily, there are immigrants too, let me finish, please. That there are primarily, we're talking about black men that have just been killed. We're talking about young, Garner wasn't that young, but they're the primary people. So to me, those should be the people on the platform. If you want to go and join and you're white, or you want to go join and you're LGBT, or you want to join, but give these guys a chance.
That's sort of setting up a hierarchy of oppression. I just want to say this about the
women's hierarchy of oppression.
Yes, it really does.
No, it's really... Hold on. Wait a second. Why is it any different than a man trying to usurp the woman's movement?
Well, this is I wanted to segue into that. Because one of the problems with the women's movement, we only saw white women. So we didn't see women for... Wait a minute.
That's
true. We didn't see women of color. We didn't see LGBT women. We didn't see...
Irene, the women's movement has been phenomenally successful. Yeah,
To whom, Marjorie, please?
It has been successful for a lot of women. More
white? white women, white middle class women.
Irene,
when we talk about affirmative action,
the group
that has benefited have been white middle class women.
If some guy pinches your butt in the office, you are a black woman and you can go someplace and complain.
Not
that
about,
is
oh,
across
you see,
the board.
And so you're assuming that the legal system
will
really protect me.
Hey,
Jim, how much time would you have?
So this is why that's why we need a cross analysis.
Okay.
Because see, you're making
the
assumption.
I don't think we need any white people on the platform.
No. But okay. Well, my point. See, it's not about elevating white people. It's about saying that this is a platform that is showing the interconnections of different coalitions.
Okay.
So that could be somebody white, Latino, LGBTQ.
I am telling you again. Well, we may have an example or two where there was some progress in a movement that was coalitional and didn't have leaders. They are very few and very far between. I mean, so the bottom. And you know what's interesting, and the last thing on this, is that clearly Marty Walsh and Deval Patrick are not your typical crush the protesters kind of people, to say the least.
Yeah.
That as an understatement. Obviously, they coordinated their message. I don't think it's coincidence. On the same day, they're both talking to the press, saying, what gives here? What are you looking for? We need to know what's going on so you're not just, quote, Deval Patrick, just disruptive. Now,
I think it was a money thing for Walsh. I think he's worried about the budget.
It's not inconceivable. They said they spent $1.5 million on policing of the three major
targets.
Overtime.
Yeah, I think that's a big deal.
Okay, can we move on to Bill Cosby? I have to say,
this is the
ultimate. We're not going to talk about yet another accuser. To me, this is, and I mean this sincerely, proof that he's really lost his marbles over this. He says, this is in the Huffington Post, that he only expects the, quote, black media to remain neutral. I don't think there are many high-profile black people in the history of this country who've been treated as positively by the so-called white media. I mean, maybe Michael Jordan and he are at that, but he's very near the top. If not, I mean, this is a sign of a man going
desperate,
off the tracks, is it not?
Yeah, I mean, we have a problem here. I mean, you know, first of all, for him to isolate just the black media and to almost challenge the black media to stay neutral.
Exactly. You're right.
It's absolutely insane. You're right. I mean, we know that historically black people are some of the most forgiving people, particularly black church-going people. We have a tendency to be upset for a little bit, go pray, and then come back out, and we sing Kumbaya, you know, in multiple languages. But here we have a huge, huge challenge. And I think that when former supermodel Beverly Johnson, first African-American to be on the cover of Vogue, came out last week and talked about her episode, her situation with Bill Cosby, I think that was a nail in the coffin. Here you have a phenomenally.
Why?
Here you have one of the most successful African-American models, first to be on the cover of Vogue, had a tremendous career, and I don't think anybody would ever question that her accusation was part of some media ploy or some
extortion
attempt.
Or extortion of money and stuff. I think there's a couple of things. One is that if a man to use the race card, I thought that was very, very interesting that he's using the race card of a man that has always stayed away from that. That's number one.
That's a good point.
True.
And I was just really, I really felt like what a cheap shot. But there's another reason why he's hoping that the black media will stay neutral, because where other sort of networks have removed his reruns, like TV Land, the black cable network is running the Bill Cosby
show. Is that
show.
True?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You can get it on Centric.
I didn't
one.
Know that.
Absolutely. So, and interestingly enough, a very well-known entertainer, Whoopi, you know, again, sort of hasn't totally side with Bill Cosby, but will not take a stance the way in which many other folks. But he's expecting the African-American community. He reminds me of many African-Americans who don't want to deal with the black community except for times when they fall down. Vanessa Williams was a classic example of that. But what he's doing here.
Well, what was with
well
her?
She was the first African-American
Miss America, and many years
she just denied that, you know, she was African American. But as soon as her throne, her crown was taken from her,
because she had a relationship or something.
Well, there was just
pictures of lesbians,
naked pictures, dancing
pictures,
right. But what I want to get at is that what makes Beverly Johnson's statement very important. It's sort of like she will be heard in the way that Anita Hill wasn't heard when she called out Clarence Thomas. We do have this politic of silence around sexual abuse and uncomfortable topics like this. So for her to come out, she has nothing to gain from this. She's not trying to extort money. Giuliani, she helps open that door in terms of let us really look at the real Bill Cosby, because truth be told, we have there have always known Bill to do this. And so this whole idea, if he says that what's keeping me sane is love and the love of womanhood, this man has clearly tremendous disdain and hatred for women.
What number we also, we I think a couple of weeks ago we said to you guys, isn't it interesting that all of his victims are white? Well, it's not the case anymore. It's not just this woman, but there's a woman a couple of weeks ago,
that
too.
That came out. That's right.
At least two African Americans. So the list is going to grow and grow. What's this? Just when the women stop coming out, he just fades into obscurity?
What a legacy. I mean, he's...
What's the first paragraph in his obituary, clearly.
Absolutely. Listen, he's there's been no accountability in terms of the number of women that he has assaulted. So this is a man that wanted to leave a kind of pristine legacy. Well, that can't happen. And the interesting thing is where a lot of, interestingly enough, where only a few black men have spoken out, like Chris Rock, you know, and the actual comedian that really
outed him, the
black community has been very silent around Bill Cosby.
Is that true?
Absolutely. And I think what I've appreciated is Spelman College, because he's given an enormous amount of money,
what
an endowed chair. Well, they abolished the chair. The chair will
they
no
did.
Longer
yeah.
continue.
Well, there's been some people who come out. I mean, Charles Barkley made an interesting statement. And you have the athletes who have been, you know, particularly predominantly African-American males. The whole Georgetown Hoya collegiate team came out with, a different – well, they did think about it, I Can't Breathe, but there was an undercutting story about some of the other stuff. I mean, one of the biggest issues here is that you have when this happens to a white male, you know, the news hits – you know, you go through the list of women or whatnot, and then it goes away. And clearly, Bill Cosby is, you know, America's dad and whatnot. And,
but don't you think that's why? No one cared about Anthony Weiner or Elliot Spitzer.
Well,
nobody cared.
But we all knew that Woody Allen was always a little strange and Roman, what is it?
Roman Polanski.
Yeah.
So, Emmett, your point is that
it's different because he's a black guy?
There is an undercurrent of race.
Yeah.
Here's the black guy who everybody accepted.
Right.
And now he's betrayed our trust, right? And so that becomes a huge thing.
Because he was an acceptable black to us.
Well, it says something about when we put acceptable black folks up, you know, we raise them up in the dominant culture and they fail us, like O.J. Simpson.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, you can't have any narrative, whether you're black or white, and it not be about race. The unfortunate thing is that this was a man that was just universal in terms of his persona. And what we got to see was Dr. Huxtable and Mr. Hyde.
That's totally true.
Yeah.
But, you know, the irony of what you say, both of you, but Emmett, you started this about, you know, we feel this huge sense of betrayal, which is why we'll never let this go. This is how we should deal with all people like this. I mean, that's the irony.
Yeah.
We shouldn't let
anybody of
them go.
I agree.
And so maybe this is
But
an
I
object.
Just want to say this, though, Emmett. I mean, one of the reasons why it has been has really been on the down low is because of race. Because a lot of those women...
Down low? How is it on the down
well,
low?
Well, his behavior on the down low around the treatment of women...
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Largely because he was a black man. And many of those women, if you look at the trajectory of his history of sexual violence, starting in 1967 into today, not only have we evolved around that, around understanding sexual assault, but just think of him trying to say that in the 60s during the Black Power movement. Think of times within, because this is not a man that had, it's episodic that he stopped at certain points.
Right.
This man was continual about this.
They're coming, also, what are they up to 20
and
now?
So,
there's no reason to assume it's not going to be 25, 30, 40.
So the fact 40? That he hasn't gone to jail, the fact that he hasn't, you know, been held accountable to it, has everything to do about race.
Well, what does that mean? He hasn't been held accountable.
The point is that those women were too afraid to bring up.
Oh, you mean on their behalf when they decided not to proceed against them? Okay, let's talk about somebody who has a reputation with women that one of you thinks is not quite what it should be. We skipped our Pope watch last week. You want to start it, Marjorie?
Well, there's this great story about the Pope making quotes that caused women to wince when he earlier this month wanted to highlight his appointment.
Marjorie's going to read these just to provoke Irene Monroe. It's pretty obvious. That's why we're doing this.
He wanted to highlight several women to this Blue Ribbon Theological Commission. He called them strawberries on the cake. When he wanted to chastise someone about their femaleness, he said, "Oh, be a mother and not an old maid." He said, "I'm wary of masculinity in a skirt." And he called Europe a grandmother no longer fertile and vibrant. I don't know what we're to make of this. I'm a little upset about it.
In a bad mood, Irene?
Let me just say this about that. He's no longer on the scale. He's off the scale.
So he's down from a two to a minus three?
He's not even on.
These contemporary comments are comments through his decades-long career. It's not like he made these comments.
They're not his decades-long career. They're in the last year.
Are they?
Yeah.
He's evolving over the last year. Emin, aren't you going to say that?
I mean, Listen, I'm not a woman, but I'm wincing. I mean, these comments are not good. They're horrible. I still leave him on a scale, maybe at about a one.
He's not even
up. Well, by the way, not to defend any of those comments, because none of them are defensible. One thing he is that we tend to ignore because he is so full of life, he's an old guy.
Yeah.
I mean, we've talked.
So we're supposed to give him a pass?
Marjorie and I are talking about how both of our fathers, one of whom was a decent person, we'll leave that, would use language about virtually everything.
Oh, yeah.
Women
terrible.
Or broads and
terrible.
All that. I mean, and I'm not defending it, but it was a function of the times because they lived in a different era. How old is this guy? In his late 70s? So you don't think, Irene, I hesitate to ask you this question because I know where we're going. You don't think he gets it at all on the woman thing?
No, but you know what? It's not even fair to say this. Jim,
what?
To say, well, he's just a function of his time, and he's the Pope of this present day.
That's true.
So,
true.
So I mean, can
Can't
we
have
hold
it both
him?
Ways,
and my
right?
point is,
you're
are right. we to say that women are not part of God's kingdom?
You mean
it's just, and then we wonder why the church, the entire body of the church appears to be anti-woman.
Isn't this, by the way, speaking of women, isn't this nun's report coming out sometime?
It's coming out tomorrow.
So what is that
coming out tomorrow?
Obviously with him, his imprimatur, what is this?
Well,
thing?
There are a lot of people, there's two different reports. The one tomorrow is about all these nuns that were visited and their orders, and then there's another one that's going to be at the leadership council. That one was a different report. But
I have the survey. Can I just share this?
Absolutely.
Okay. This is the survey here, and I was just very, because first of all, as we know, nuns appear to be a dying institution now. So this is the Time survey found out that 3% were 40 or younger, 37% were over 70, and 12% were over 80. The medium age for a nun is 65. The latest data comes at a time when the church has found a steady exodus of nuns. The majority of nuns, it's very, very interesting, do favor ordination, even though in that survey they say they would not do it themselves.
Liberal, a lot of the nuns.
Yeah.
That's right.
They're off the reservation.
What's the name of the woman, Nuns on the Bus? Who was
Simone Campbell.
She was unbelievable, but go ahead. Yeah.
And interestingly enough, the biggest issue for nuns, even some that are conservative, is their treatment by the church.
I know. Well, it's terrible that they're investigating these nuns. The nuns are in the soup kitchens. The nuns are doing all this good work for the poor.
The investigation is necessary because we need to do better. I mean, you know, the Vatican needs to do better. The Catholic Church
needs
to do
better. It's not do better. It's to do away with it.
Okay.
It's not to do better.
Speaking of...
do better says there's hope. Okay.
Irene's on a roll. No
okay,
one has accomplished anything. I think that's clear.
No, because he's not on the scale anymore. It's very interesting because I was very hopeful about this Pope.
Yeah.
But to take that kind of attitude and to repeat old attitudes that he may have had when he was a young man today,
Irene,
it's just unconscionable.
I just want to be clear. You do not consider yourself a strawberry on the cake. I want to be clear about that.
Maybe not. Okay, before you go,
okay.
One of the great issues of the time we don't have time with for you, we're going to discuss with our callers in a minute. I want to start with you, Emmett, because you're a very thoughtful person. Then we'll get to Irene, who's also a very thoughtful person. Fake or real when it comes to the Christmas tree? And not just which one, why, please.
Real. I love the smell. I love the smell.
That's good enough for me. I love that. Now, Irene Monroe, I'm afraid to hear what you have to say. Don't tell. She's going to say no tree at all. I know this. Is that not where you're going with this? It's a pagan symbol. Is that what you're going to say?
Christmas is my favorite time of year.
And?
So there you have it. Oh, it has to be. You know,
it has to be real?
It has to be real.
Great.
It's so real that
great.
I keep my tree until all the pines fall off.
Oh, that's great. When it's a fire hazard.
That's right.
Fabulous.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Perfect.
You know, and in May, people will say, why is this wreath still on your door? Because course, every day is Christmas to me.
Every
That's
day
beautiful.
Is Christmas.
Thank
okay.
you both. Thank
Reverend
you.
Ira Moreau is a syndicated religion columnist. Reverend Emmett Price is a professor of music at Northeastern. His latest book is The Black Church and Hip-Hop Culture Toward Bridging the Generational Divide. Thank you guys very much for
Thanks,
coming in,
too.
As always. Coming up, though the Revs here believe in peace on earth, we're about to create a huge schism. Asking you, when it comes to the Christmas tree, do you chomp down a real one or unbox the fake? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.